Welcome back to the Super Bowl Sunday edition of Behind the Headlines. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Thanks so much for listening today. We'll have our first ever opinion segment in today's show. Columnist James Causey joins me later to talk about the new show about the O.J. Simpson trial. We'll also hear from our business intern, Madeline Kennedy, on the rules about Uber at General Mitchell International Airport. First, what's it like to be in the room as a surgery is being performed? Reporter John Faber talks to Mary Louise Schumacher about his latest story and the lengths he went to while reporting on it.
John, you have a story this week about an epilepsy patient, a young man who has just undergone a kind of new and experimental treatment. As I understand it, he's had a neurostimulator placed directly into his brain to stimulate his brain. Can you tell us just a little bit about who this young man is, how you came to follow his case in particular, and what is this procedure?
Sure. His name is Ryan Dietrich, and he's 24 years old. He's a sort of a native of Waukesha, Wisconsin. And he's had intractable seizures really since he's been about 15 years old. You know, he's one of these seizure or epilepsy patients who, despite medicine and even the potential for surgery, brain surgery that could eliminate his seizures, he just can't get relief. He's on five different medicines. Mm-hmm. And it's really disrupted his life. He can't drive. He has been hard. It's been hard to work, to have a job. He's 24 years old, and a lot of his friends from high school have drifted apart because, you know, 20 somethings often drink when they go out and socialize, and if he drinks, he'll have a seizure the next day. There's a good chance he'll have a seizure. So it's really been a huge disruption on his life. So he found out about a new treatment that was being offered at Frederick Hospital. It's called the RNS Neurostimulator, and it's essentially a system that delivers electricity to the brain. It's a device that actually monitors the brain for abnormal activity, and if it spots something that it thinks is a seizure, it delivers a certain amount of electricity to try to disrupt that and hopefully prevent the seizure. And it got approved about a year or 2 years ago. He was the second patient to get this at Frederick Hospital. And he had it put in October 12th. And we've been essentially following him from the day of his surgery until now.
And so he was a good candidate for this procedure because his case is particularly difficult.
Most people with seizures or epilepsy can be controlled to some extent with medicines, but he couldn't. There's also a surgical procedure that can be done where they actually take out a small part of the brain, mm-hmm. which can actually work very well if you're the right candidate for it, but he was not a candidate for that. His problem is that his seizures were coming from both sides of the brain, and if you take out pieces of the brain on both sides, you could lose function and be, you know, severely disabled by that. So he didn't really have any other options.
And this procedure, and as I understand it, you actually were present for the surgery, electrodes were placed pretty deep inside of his brain, right? Can you tell us a little bit about how this actually works?
It depends who you talk to. Some people will give you explanations, and other people will say, you know, we really don't know why it works. But, I mean, there's theories, that electricity can excite neurons. You know, the brain is an electrochemical organ, and the delivering current to it can excite these neurons, or it can inhibit their electrical activity. There's another theory that by delivering electricity to the brain, you can stimulate the production of neurotransmitters, which are brain chemicals that are important for a lot of the neurologic functions that we have. But I mean, the general theory is that it basically disrupts this abnormal activity and settles it down and prevents it from multiplying and becoming sort of uniform and turning into a real seizure.
And finally, John, can you just talk a little bit about, because you've done it a number of times now, what it's like to be a reporter, kind of witnessing and reporting on a surgery like that?
Yeah, I mean, I've been in the operating room, you know, probably a few dozen times for a lot of different things. And it's really very interesting. It's exciting at times. You're basically standing off, and I'm always worried that I'm going to, you know, sneeze or do something that's going to screw up what's going on. I tend to stay away from things. You know, there's this. You know, there's a lot of sterile equipment, so you can't get, you know, there's blue around, like blue, and you stay away from that. You stay out of the way of the doctors. But then, you know, sometimes you're like, for instance, I took some pictures during this. So I needed to get close. So I had to kind of sneak in and try to, get into a spot that I didn't really feel comfortable being at, but I needed to, you know, get the picture. So it's fun seeing how it works because it's – you know, there's a team of people who work and really closely, and they have this stuff down. It's kind of fascinating seeing how good they are at doing it. Mm-hmm. There's things that occur that you just sort of never expect to hear, like, or never expect to see, like smelling bone burning when they're cutting it away, or yeah. I've been in operating rooms where doctors like to play music and they hear, country and Western music playing. When I've even seen docs who, are looking at their cell phones to see if they got messages when they have breaks or, it's so you never know what you're going to see. Mm-hmm. So it is fun. And I think by doing that, by being there and being able to describe what happens in the operating room, you can bring the story to life a little bit more.
John's story ran in Sunday's edition of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can find it there or online at jsonline.com. Perhaps you read Oscar Wilde's Dorian Gray in high school or college, but what's it like to translate that novel to the stage, particularly during a ballet? Editor Jim Higgins found out.
Hi, this is Jim Higgins, arts editor of the Journal Sentinel. This week, I talked with artistic director Michael Pink about the Milwaukee Ballet's new production of Dorian Gray, based on the Oscar Wilde novel. Michael Pink is famous for his ballets based on stories, but he's doing something different in this one. He's added a speaking part.
That I wanted to explore the use of some of the texts, some of Wilde's text, and have the spoken word as truly as he uses it in the book as a seductive element that is the root of the corruption, and to have the beauty portrayed through dance, because nothing is more beautiful than looking at the human body, a well-trained body moving,
right.
And so you have this silence of beauty, and it's corrupted by Lord Henry, who speaks and entices him and everybody else to indulge in excess of pleasure.
In Oscar Wilde's story, the human Dorian Gray stays youthful while his painted portrait grows older and uglier. Pink is giving that a twist in this ballet.
There is no painted picture. You will see the dancer as Dorian, and then you will see the effects of the picture to some degree. You'll see some of the action through this.
So this is a little like Elephant Man. The dancer has to suggest the physical corruption of Dorian.
Yeah. And again, there's no better way to do that than in dance.
Right.
Because
as
soon as you start to contort something and you show physical pain and angst, that's what dance does monstrously well. There's one moment when, in profile, you see him step through the picture, and as he steps through, he literally convulses.
While he generally sticks close to Wilde's novel, Pink has made one significant change for the stage.
What I wanted to do was find a way to create, also for Dorian, a conscience, because in the book I think it comes across, because it really talks about so much about him. So I'm using the actress Sybil Vane, mm-hmm. whom he falls in love with. And once she commits suicide, in true Shakespearean style, she keeps coming back as a ghost, and it pricks his conscience and pricks his conscience.
The desperate desire of the title character in Dorian Gray is something familiar to people who work in ballet.
Well, think about this, Jim. I mean, there's this story about a young, beautiful man who wants immortality, wants to stay young.
Yeah, well,
All of these dancers are like Dorian. Is that they're hanging on to their youth and their physicality as long as they can, but it will be taken away from them in their 30s.
The Milwaukee Ballet performs Dorian Gray February 12 through 14 and February 19 through 21 at the Pabst Theater. Read my interview with Michael Pink in the February 7th Sunday Journal Sentinel or online at tapmilwaukee.com.
Have you tried to take an Uber home from General Mitchell? Well, technically you can't. It hasn't stopped drivers, but it's in a legal gray area. Reporter Chelsea Lewis sat down with business intern Madeline Kennedy. Madeline's doing a story about some changes that could be coming when it comes to Uber and General Mitchell.
So, Maddie, you have a story on Sunday kind of about Uber, Lyft, these ride-sharing services, and their relationship with the Milwaukee airport, General Mitchell. It's kind of an interesting timing for this story for a different reason with Uber. You know, they just came out with their new logo that's kind of seen some controversy. But can you kind of take us back, like, what exactly is the background on this? What's going on?
Sure, yeah. Obviously, Uber and Lyft have been becoming pretty popular throughout the country. And recently, big regional airports like LAX and San Francisco, especially out west, have started to make deals with Uber and Lyft so that they can do business at their airports. So other airports now in the Midwest are gradually starting to create their own programs that require Uber drivers to have special licenses, permits, pay particular fees so that they can work in the airport area.
So is this something that taxis already have to do or other, you know, ride services?
The airport has its own fleet of taxis, owned obviously by the airport, and that's usually what you see when you go out to the taxi area, when you walk out a baggage claim. But recently, city taxis were granted medallions to work the area, and so they had to acquire special permits, pay special fees, and now Uber's kind of starting to seek the same privilege.
So is it technically illegal for them to operate right now at the airport, or is it just kind of a gray area?
It's more of a legal gray area because it's pretty hard to distinguish between an Uber coming to pick someone up at baggage claim versus, like, your friend just coming in the car. So they can't be seen doing business in the taxi area of the, you know, of the airport. But nothing's stopping them from just pulling up and picking people up, obviously. They do, you know, pretty well. They do a lot of business there every day.
Sure, sure, definitely. And I think you mentioned in your story that some taxi drivers have kind of made the argument that Uber and Lyft are undercutting their prices a bit. Can you speak to that
right,
a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's much cheaper to take an Uber or Lyft to the airport. I looked it up from my my apartment in downtown Milwaukee, and it takes about costs about $15 to $20 to take an Uber or Lyft to the airport, but it's going to cost about $30 to $35 if you'd want to take a city taxi. So obviously people are kind of leaning more towards the Uber and Lyft services when they're looking for ways to get to the airport. So a lot of taxi drivers, including a couple that I talked to, felt that they couldn't really match Uber and Lyft's prices because they're obviously held to certain prices and standards by the city of Milwaukee. So it's really difficult for them to compete. And especially since they just acquired these medallions and special permits, they're kind of starting to feel a little cheated.
Sure, definitely. Mm-hmm. So where does this story go from here? Is the airport have a timeline on when they might be instituting a new policy for Uber and Lyft, or is it kind of up in the air?
Yeah, sure. I talked to Pat Rowe, a spokesperson from the airport, and she said they are working on a deal with Uber and Lyft right now, and she expected something to a deal to be reached within, you know, probably the next month or, yeah, 1 or 2 months. Anyway, we should be seeing a final decision hopefully by this summer.
Okay, so will that potentially mean higher rates for Uber and Lyft, or will there be an added fee or something?
It could, yeah. At, like, Minneapolis, you know, the Uber drivers have to pay $6 to get into the area to pick you up. So that fee is automatically passed on to the drivers. So onto the riders. So it's possible that they ultimately will be, Uber riders will ultimately be paying more to be picked up from the airport, especially by the cheaper services like UberX and UberXL.
If you missed that story in Sunday's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, you can find it online at jsonline.com/business. Where were you when the O.J. Simpson trial was going on? Opinions columnist James Causey would bet that you can answer that question. That's part of the reason why he wanted to write about the recently launched TV show, The People vs. O.J. Simpson. Here's James with more.
I think everybody could go back 20 years and remember exactly where they were when the O.J. Simpson case took place. We remember where we were during the Bronco chase, the low-speed chase, I like to call it. We remember where we were when the verdict was read. I was in a newsroom when the verdict was read, and I still remember how we all gathered around the television set, and some of the white reporters, they were looking, and the black reporters sort of gathered together. And when the verdict was read, it was just complete silence. I still remember that. And I also remember looking at television later that night and seeing how at historically black colleges, how the black students were celebrating like they won a lottery or something. And what people fail to understand that this was right after the Rodney King verdict, you know, about 2 years later. And so a lot of people felt like this was payback. And when the miniseries started called People versus O.J., I mean, with Cuba, starring Cuba Gooding Jr., John Travolta, and they have a star cast, it brings you back to those times and those memories. And so I wanted to write about it, not just to talk about, you know, where I was at that time, but I wanted to talk about how far we've come when it comes to race relations. And so that's what I'm going to tackle in my column on Sunday.
Were you nervous, or how did you feel when you found out that they were revisiting that issue, the O.J. Simpson case, at this point in time?
Well, I was surprised that not a lot has been done on this in the past, you know, in 20 years. This is going to be a 10-part miniseries, and the first one aired this past Tuesday, and it received more than 5.1 million viewers. It's the highest-rated FX show ever. So people are tuning in. People are interested in it. And I learned a lot of things that I didn't even know about the case, you know, but a lot of things I was, like, familiar with. I think the thing that I'm most interested in is how will I feel after the last part? Will I still feel the same? I think a lot of those kids that celebrated on college campuses and things like that at the time he was found or at the time he was acquitted, I don't know if I would want to know how they feel today. Do they still think he was innocent, or do they feel like he was guilty, but they were happy that he got off because it's in some way it validated or it made up for what happened to Rodney King? That's an interesting question that I really don't know the answer to.
So this is not the first show that's come out recently that deals with issues of race. You have shows like American Crime mm-hmm. that are also doing the same thing. Are you hopeful that media interpretations of these issues will further the dialogue about them, or are you more apprehensive about it?
Well, that's an interesting question. I speak to a lot of colleges and universities, and I was recently at Colonel Stritch a week ago, and I was talking with a class about issues of race. And I had everybody close their eyes, and I turned out the light so I could only see them. And I said, how many people consider themselves racist? And it was roughly a class of about 20. About 10 hands went up. And I said, okay, how many people are working to get rid of these feelings? And then the same 10 people hands went up. Then I said, how many people in this group have friends who are racist in your circle? Nearly all the hands went up. Then I said, well, how many people are... Do you correct these people? Do you tell them that that's wrong? And the hands went up. Then I said, well, whose responsibility is it to tackle the issue of race? Is it the president? And they're like, no. Is it you? And everybody raised their hands. Then I said, well, do you know how to tackle the issue of race? Do you know how to do it? If you do, raise your hand. And no hand went up. Because the problem is, and this was a diverse class, the problem is we all know we have a race problem, but we don't know how to fix it. We don't know what to do. We don't know how to reach out to someone that doesn't look like us and try to get to know them. I mean, you know, you go to any church or classroom lunchroom, and you could almost see how we're divided. You know, blacks sit together, whites sit together. At least that's how is at my church and when I go visit schools. And I wonder why we have such a hard time interacting with people who are not like us when it's just not – when we're not forced to do it, like at work and things like that. And so my challenge to the classroom was to reach out to someone who doesn't look like you and try to understand them. And they said they would take that challenge. So when I go back in another 3 months, I'm going to see how that little experiment went.
If you haven't had a chance to read James's column, you can find it online at jsonline.com/opinion. With Iowa down, presidential candidates are heading to New Hampshire. Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gilbert joined this week's JS on Politics show live with the latest.
All right, we're joined now by Craig Gilbert. Our Washington Bureau Chief was on the ground in New Hampshire preparing for a Donald Trump rally. Craig, tell us a little bit, I mean, set the stage a little bit for our viewers and listeners. What's the difference in the electorate between Iowa and New Hampshire? These are very different states in many ways, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, they do share a very white electorate, but there's some big differences. I mean, the biggest difference in some ways is that New Hampshire is a primary where it's the biggest turnout primary in the country, and it has been for many cycles, which is the precise opposite of Iowa, where because of the caucus system, even in a big year, like in a big turnout like we saw last week, it's still a really small percentage of the eligible voters that are actually participating. So New Hampshire is a much broader electorate in that respect. And then when you look at the parties, particularly on the Republican side, the Republican electorate is much different. I mean, you don't have anywhere near the population of evangelicals you had in Iowa. It's a more secular kind of economic conservatives, in some cases sort of hawkish conservatives. Very different there. That has big implications for the Republican candidates. And on the Democratic side, obviously, you have the senator next door, Bernie Sanders, which is one reason why he's favored here.
All right. Well, one of the adages in politics is there's three tickets out of Iowa. We know who kind of got those tickets, but who has the most at stake here in New Hampshire now a week later?
Well, Bernie Sanders really has to win because he's been way ahead in the polls, and this is a good state for him. If he loses New Hampshire, which doesn't seem like it's likely to happen, that would just be a massive, massive blow for him. Hillary Clinton is just trying to close the gap and finish respectably here. On the Republican side, a lot of people are facing elimination. I mean, you've got a trio of governors, John Kasich, a former governor, Jeb Bush, and Chris Christie, who are scrambling for their lives, and they have to do something in New Hampshire to keep going. They were not factors in Iowa. Donald Trump has to win New Hampshire because he's been ahead here. Marco Rubio would like to beat out the governors, and Ted Cruz is not expected to do necessarily that well here, so the pressure is off of him a little bit.
All right, so if you look at the polls, Trump is a big leader on the Republican side and Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side. So talking about the Democrats, how close does Hillary Clinton have to make it, do you think, or is she just a matter of, you know, putting in an effort and waiting for South Carolina and more favorable states?
Yeah, I mean, it's really more psychological than anything else. I mean, she could lose by 10 or 15 points and it would be a psychological blow to her campaign, but then she goes to South Carolina where the electorate is much better for her because she's better known and does better, much better than Bernie Sanders does right now with African-American voters in these southern states. They're a huge part of the Democratic vote. So she's going to start winning primaries unless something strange happens after New Hampshire. But it'll affect the psychology of the campaign, you know, what her losing margin is if she loses New Hampshire. And on the Republican side, you know, it's like I said, there are people facing elimination. We've already winnowed the field down to 9 from 17. It still favors Donald Trump to have so many people fragmenting the vote. And there's a lot of competition for those sort of more mainstream pragmatic Republicans. There's going to be a big independent vote. We don't know which party it's going to materialize in. So lots of wild cards.
Yeah, well, on the Republican side, it's hard to see, I guess, more than one of the governors that you mentioned, you know, making it out in New Hampshire. Is there one who seemingly has the most energy or best organization out there that we should be watching for?
Well, you know, John Kasich has sort of been that candidate, it seems like, for a long time. It's an open question, though, as to whether he can seal the deal. And there's a lot of, there's a lot of aggressive attacks being made within this crowd. I mean, the Bush people are fighting the Rubio campaign and fighting the Kasich campaign, and the Christie people are going after Rubio. Because of the very thing you just said, which is that they're all in competition with each other, particularly these three governors and former governors. And so they're training their fire on each other, even though they share a lot of things politically.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there for today. Please follow Craig Gilbert's coverage from New Hampshire at jsonline.com, and we'll have you back next week to talk about what happened in New Hampshire. Thanks, Craig.
Look forward to it.
For the latest in our political coverage, visit jsonline.com/politics. You can find a full replay of that show online as well. It's also available as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. In their podcast last week, Bucks beat writer Charles Gardner and Matt Velasquez addressed the question, are the young Bucks improving?
You look at the Bucks team and you know they're young, and young teams are prone to inconsistency and up and down play and being streaky and all that stuff. I'm seeing that a lot with the Marquette team that I cover, you know, day to day. But do you think that even through the ups and downs, do you think the Bucks are getting better as a team, or are they just being up and down without showing much progress?
That's really a good question, man. I mean, and I think that's hard to gauge, but I think they are getting better in some ways, but you know, the starters are playing. I guess here's what I would say, Ben. The starters are playing as a unit. Yes, they have injuries. They've been mostly to the bench, which of course has been crippling, as we've documented. But you know, they could have starters down. they have their starting five. And that's huge. Remember when at the beginning of the season, because Parker's injury last year, we said they've never played with this group. Well, now they have. Now every night we go to Kidd and ask about the lineup, and it's kind of a joke because the lineup's the same. You know, it's not changing. Right now, these five players, they want to see how they are playing together and if they are getting better. And, you know, I think MCW's had his ups and downs, some great games, some games where he disappears. Last night he's going against that great backcourt from Portland. And Matt, that really is a great backcourt, I think, Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum. McCollum had 30 points, and this kid is really going to be a good player. He can get his shot off, he can shoot the three, 30 points. The Bucks actually held him down, if you recall, in that game in November in Milwaukee that they won by 2 points. And they tried to post him up with Chris. And Chris tried to post him up again last night, but with much less success. And, of course, Chris has been in a slump. He was 0 for 9 on his first 9 shots last night. But that didn't prove to be as successful as it was in Milwaukee. But I think, you know, you got Chris, who's made some strides here now this season. He's been in a shooting slump lately, but you've got to say he looks like a strong shooting guard for the team. You know, Parker, Giannis, Monroe, MCW. So I do see some things that are better. The Bucks certainly have potential to play better after the break with all these home games. I think it'll be interesting to see. Matt, they may be out of it, basically, but how are they going to play? Are they going to play together and keep improving? You know, that was one good comment by Giannis last night. I said, well, how are you guys going to stick together with this slipping away on you now? And he said, if we win 10 in a row or we lose 10 in a row or whatever happens the rest of the year, he said, we got to stick together. Kind of to your point, saying we have to keep improving for the future.
To find more from Matt and Charles, visit jsonline.com/sports. And with that, I'll wrap up the show. Thanks once again for listening, and tune in next week for more.